I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and our conversation today is about gambling and why a lifelong poker player still plays at the table where she can read a poker face but has sworn off online gambling. First, though, there is news today that President Bush has rolled back a mechanism for oversight of intelligence gathering that was put in place after Watergate. The Boston Globe reports today that last month, President Bush stripped the largely secret Intelligence Oversight Board of much of its job of keeping an eye out for illegal spying. The board is supposed to be the watchdog group inside the executive branch. It's made up of a handful of private citizens. Reporter Charlie Savage broke the story today. He's written a book about the expansion of executive power under President Bush and was the first to write about Bush's excessive use of signing statements, which give the president the right to reinterpret law. So, Charlie, walk us through this news story. President Ford, we understand, created this Intelligence Oversight Board by executive order after Watergate. So what was it supposed to do?
Well, the Intelligence Oversight Board that Ford set up in 1976 had the job of being a watchdog roaming around the intelligence community, taking reports directly from inspectors general every 3 months from the intelligence community, looking out for possible illegal activity, either activities that broke a law or an executive order, and then to tell not just the president about that, but also the attorney general.
And how is President Bush changing the role of the oversight committee?
In his executive order, Bush stripped the board of much of its independence and its authority. Most significantly, he removed its mandate, its authority to make criminal referrals to the attorney general. He also terminated its relationship, its oversight relationship with the general counsels and the inspector generals of each intelligence agency. They still talk to the president, but not the Justice Department, and they don't receive regular reports from the inspector general anymore. And in a variety of ways, the call for them to conduct their own independent investigations has been watered down.
Well, the White House says that all government officials are supposed to report any law-breaking. So, you know, changing this rule is not a problem.
Well, you know, the White House had to say something, and that's what they said. There is a law in the books that gives every government official the responsibility, if they learn of lawbreaking, to tell it to the Justice Department. So they say, well, it's meaningless that from the core list of responsibilities and mandates of this board that language was deleted. You can take that as you will.
Well, as we said, this oversight board was instituted by President Ford by executive order. And you also write today that President Bush has also changed the rules on presidential executive orders themselves. How so?
Well, one of the things we learned a couple months ago that was very interesting was with Senator Whitehouse from Rhode Island was given an opportunity to look at some of the secret Office of Legal Counsel memos that have not been generally released to Congress and certainly not to the public. One of the things he revealed was that the Bush administration has come up with a theory that executive orders are not binding, that the president can authorize spies to violate his own executive order without revoking that executive order. Senator Whitehouse brought that up specifically in the context of an executive order that restricts spying on U.S. citizens when they're traveling overseas. And why that's important is because it was previously widely understood that the executive orders were the rules, and a president was always free to change the rules, but he had to do so by revoking the executive order, and that would give both the public and, even more importantly, Congress notice that the rules were changing if they wanted to respond by passing some kind of legislation. And now it means that the rules, who knows whether or not they're even being obeyed by the executive branch.
Well, and this whole watchdog group that President Bush has now reduced was instituted by Ford because Congress wanted even tougher reforms. Do you think Congress will now move again for tougher reforms, given that so much oversight has been stripped away?
Well, look, I think the important thing to understand about this is if this was just one thing that happened in isolation, probably Congress wouldn't even notice. It would just be one change. But what's important is that was one of a series of reforms that were instituted after the Church Committee investigation of 1975-76 and the Watergate era, all of which imposed more oversight and accountability on the intelligence communities. And one of the things the article gets into is if you look down that list of changes that were made, new rules that were imposed, they have been rather systematically hollowed out, exceptions carved into them, scaled back in ways that leave them in place, just as the Intelligence Oversight Board is still there superficially, but have sort of defanged them. And this is just the latest example of that kind of counter-reformation movement we've seen.
Charlie Savage, reporter for the Boston Globe, author of Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy. Charlie, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, on this Friday, a good book that's also a cautionary tale. Author Martha Frankel grew up with gambling. Her mother clicked the mahjong tiles with her girlfriends, but Martha preferred to watch the men's poker game her dad ran in the next room. Martha didn't take up poker herself until she was in her mid-40s and researching a screenplay. Then she took it up with a vengeance, soaking hands crippled by shuffling cards in ice water, stunning her all-guy Wednesday night poker game into silence with a winning hand. And even though she began to arrange her life around her playing schedule, she said she was still under control until she discovered online poker.
When I have a bankroll of $3,000, I go to a $10-$20 hold'em game. I get beat by players that are staying in with crap. I get beat by players that are laughing at me. The only common thread is that I get beat. The money doesn't last 4 days. I will stop tomorrow, I tell myself, or Monday, first of the month, right after I win back what they owe me.
And Martha Frankel shares her story of addiction to online poker in her memoir, Hats and Eyeglasses, A Family Love Affair with Gambling. She joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
What a fun read and then a disturbing read, you know, as you get pulled into online gambling. Let's start with the title, Hats and Eyeglasses.
When I was about 4, I was in the house. My mother was playing mahjong with her girlfriends in the kitchen, and my dad was playing poker with their husbands in the living room. And one of the guys said, I have hats and eyeglasses. And I said, what does that mean? And he bent down to show me his hand. He said, it means I have crapola. It's like when a ship goes down and all that floats to the surface is hats and eyeglasses. And it became code in our family for when you were doing bad, but especially when you were doing bad at gambling.
And, of course, it becomes a metaphor for what happens to you by the end of the book. But, you know, that family where you were the 4-year-old, 6-year-old, you know, sitting in people's laps, watching the game, a loving family, lots of aunts and uncles that weren't really related to you.
Right.
Gambling had a really great feel to it.
It did. And I, you know what? Gambling is enticing because it's pretty great. You know, I went to the track with my father. I loved it.
In fact, you got the nickname the Grecian because what happened?
I picked a really long shot at a Belmont Stakes, and they started calling me the Grecian in respect to the odds maker, Jimmy the Greek. Mm. You know, I loved it. I loved all of it. I loved playing cards. My cousins and I bet on everything. We just, that was the way it was in my family. And you needed to put up the money. You know, you put up or shut up.
Right. But you didn't take it up, as we said, until you were older. You married a man, Steve, because he didn't even watch football.
Yeah, I didn't know the difference between football and I called him during the World Series, and he asked me for a date. And I said, aren't you going to watch the game? He said, no, I don't like football. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to marry this guy. He didn't know that a baseball game was on that night.
He didn't know baseball was World Series.
Yeah, he didn't know any of it.
Right.
And that, I thought, would be a good thing for me because I had been drawn into, did in college, bet a lot, and then sort of moved away from it.
Well, and let's just say that as you write later, the long list of things you didn't get addicted to included heroin and cocaine and Quaaludes and LSD, and it seemed as if, you know, you'd been lucky, and he seemed like a nice, safe bet.
Yeah.
Then you sound like you have a terrific entertainment career going. You're dancing the conga with Chris Walken. Mm-hmm. You go CD shopping with Jeff Bridges. You know, you've got a really good career going. And start researching a screenplay and go to a Wednesday night guys poker game to learn more about poker. What was that feeling going back into that thing in your 40s that you'd grown up with?
It was as if 40 years had slipped by and the same men were sitting there with the same kind of, you know, I've been around women. I have a lot of women friends. I love being around women. But there's that thing with women of, how are you? What are you thinking? How do you feel? I started playing poker with these guys and on the way home, I asked my buddy if one of them was married. He said, I have no idea.
Right.
They never talked. They talked about golf and poker.
Yeah.
And it was really sort of refreshing.
You fit in. At first, you didn't, you know what you were doing, but boy, you got really good. There's that moment where you stun everyone into silence with your winning hand.
Yeah.
And go on to poker cruises and, like we said, you know, playing so much that your hands hurt. start rearranging your schedule, start turning down interview assignments so that you can, you know, pursue poker. But you say that you were in control. That doesn't sound like it's in control.
I was obsessed, sure, you know, but it's that way you get about a new hobby or a new, I mean, I remember when I first started knitting, I used to dream about yarn. I used to, you know, it was that kind of obsession.
And by the way, what made you good?
Well, everything I'd been doing for the last 20 years, watching people, listening to people, I can look around this room and close my eyes and remember everything where it is. And also, I'd been doing the interviews for a long time, so I understand that a lot of it is subtext. The question you're asking is not really what you want to know. And at the poker table, that's exactly the thing that'll make people relax. And I don't know, I think I was just born to do it.
Plus, you could also tell. You knew when people were cheating.
Yeah.
Yeah, you.
Yeah, I knew the first night I played with my Wednesday night game, there was a guy at the game who was cheating. I knew it within 5 minutes.
Right.
I didn't know what he was doing. It took me a long time to find out, but I knew the first night that he was cheating.
Well, now you come to online gambling, online poker. You can't look around that room. You can't read someone else's face. What starts to happen when you start playing online poker?
From the beginning, I wasn't good at it. But instead of saying, okay, like I wanted to play hockey, but I couldn't skate, so I wouldn't do it again, I kept going back to this thing and back to this thing and trying to figure out the way in.
So here's where I think by your definition it crossed from an obsession like knitting to an addiction. How bad did it get?
It got as bad as it could get for me. I was losing a lot of money and I was, you know, nobody knew.
Lying to your husband?
I never even told him. I told nobody.
You're staying off the phone. You're keeping friends from calling you to keep the internet open.
I kept telling everybody to stop bothering me. I was busy, 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 busy.
Picking fights with your husband so that you could go and cry over your losses.
And I think it was the classic, you know, when they say insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different outcome. That's really what it was. And I have felt from the beginning that online gambling is a different animal than live gambling. And now I'm getting a lot of feedback from the book, from gamblers, from people in Gamblers Anonymous. And they say that it's like what happened when crack cocaine came out as opposed to cocaine. Not that I'm advocating any of them. But I think online addiction is really going to be a huge, it's just not just me. It's impossible that it would just be me.
No. And you started finding that out because you went to 12-step groups for gamblers.
I did. It didn't work out well for me, but I tell everybody who's looking for help to try them, not me. I mean, what do I know?
Your first group, yeah, it was you and I think five guys, and you said it felt like a poker game.
Well, it was more than that. I went there, and they were talking about, everybody said, you know, I've only been gambling free for like 12 days, 40 days. I've been in Gamblers Anonymous for 7 years. I said, well, what happened? Oh, I went to Atlantic City last week. Well, that was what I wanted to hear. Plus, it was five guys sitting around talking about the horses, cards, and baseball. That's my life. I love that life.
And also, it felt like a poker game.
Yeah, and they seemed like such losers. And, you know, of course, it took me a long time to realize that I was one of them.
Martha Frankl. When we come back, how she broke her online addiction. Later, your letters. Back in a minute, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're speaking with author Martha Frankl. Her book, Hats and Eyeglasses, is about her addiction to online poker. So, Martha, how did you break that online addiction? We're curious because you still keep playing in your Wednesday night game.
I do. I know. And there's a lot of people in Gamblers Anonymous who freak out when they hear that. But the paradigm has to change because at the most, Gamblers Anonymous will tell you that they have a 15% success rate. That means that 85% don't work. So we have to change the paradigm in how there are heroin addicts who could smoke a joint. There may be gamblers who can do some things and not others. I have no idea.
But
really,
you're saying,
Robin,
for you.
For me, that was a terrible addiction that had nothing to do with that social fun thing that I do on Wednesday nights with people I really adore. How I stopped was the way anybody stops any addiction is I was shamed into it. My mother, who was getting old, had called one day crying and just said, you know, what have I done to break your heart that you've, you know, turned your back on me? And that made me, I don't want to say it made me stop because that sounds like it was easy. It made me turn off the computer for a day, and then one more day. And then I went away for a week, and then it had been 10 days. And then every day that I didn't do it, you know, I mean, that's what they mean by minute, and then I realized that I was breathing again and that I was starting to be the person that I remembered.
Particularly hard for you to turn off the computer. You're a journalist.
I know.
But also your mom. I'm just thinking that you read at one point, I think the words were something like, that gambling had been the currency with which your family spoke to each other and shared love. And here, I mean, she had given you this in part.
And she didn't know. She didn't know what it was. I never told her. And funny enough, I waited till she died until I pitched this book. And now I could shoot myself because she would have been having so much fun following this with me. You know what I mean? She loved this. And it was the currency of our life. When I started playing poker again in my mid-40s, she was starting to go blind. But she would call me every night and tell me stories. And she really taught me how to play poker. She would tell me stories about how she played when she was a kid. And then I started picking her up and taking her to Atlantic City with me. And she was terrific, even half blind. You know, and so I just, that is my one regret, is that she's not here to hear this. And then I didn't tell her. I wish she had known.
What the thing was that was pulling you away from
her. Yeah, because even when I stopped and I would go down there and she'd, you know, she'd just sort of stroke my hand and say, you want to tell me, Cookie? I'd say no, because I thought it would break her heart. But I now know that it was my heart I was worried about.
Yeah. You talk about how, you know, one of the painful things is that your husband, you loved so much, you didn't tell him anything. Is it true? We were reading the New York Times article, an interview that you gave, in which you said did you ever tell him how much money you lost?
No, but the day the Times article, he read it first in the Times, because that was one of the things about the Times, was that they wouldn't do the story unless I told, you know,
how much money
I lost. And even when he read the book, and he did ask me, and he was so freaked out by it. Who wouldn't be when you find out the person you love the most has been lying and cheating? It's, you know, it's heartbreaking.
And spending your mutual money.
Yeah. And, you know, he works very hard. He's an artist, and $100 to him is an enormous amount of money. To a gambler, it's not that much. And I've always had a different headset about money than he did. So when Joyce Wadler from the New York Times said, when did you tell Steve how much money you lost? I said, when is the piece coming out? And she said, you're kidding, right? And I said, no.
The first he read it?
Yeah.
How much was it?
Between 50 and 70, I'd say, $1,000.
What did he say?
Well, he's been incredible. I don't think he gets it. He doesn't really understand the addictive nature. But he's been with me for a long time, 30-something years. And he knows my family. He's seen my family at work, and they, you know, have been trying to get him, as Joyce Wadler said, involved in their cockamamie scheme since the day he met me. I don't think he was surprised by it. I think he was surprised that it happened in my mid-40s and not in my mid-20s when he met me. Here's something else I think I should say.
Please.
At the casinos, it's regulated. There's somebody watching. There's a camera above head. But online, you don't know if it's you alone in your office and four other guys alone in another office together saying, I have this, I have that. You don't know what's going on. It's completely unregulated. It's done offshore. And I think that's one of the things that's going to have to be regulated.
Do you think that you were losing because you didn't have your tools at hand that you'd have in a room where you could look in someone's eyes or memorize cards? Or do you think that they're manipulating the game?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. And I think that that's something to think about. And it's, people say to me, how could you play online? It seems so risky. And I know that. And I'm sort of risk averse, even though I don't sound it. You know what I mean? I'm very clever about what might hurt me. There was something about this that just slipped over the line.
Yeah.
I mean, there are millions of sites where you can gamble, because you can do anything online. You can play poker, you can play blackjack, you can play slots, you can do anything. But there are millions of sites that talk about who's cheating and if there are robots playing. And I have no idea if any of that is true. I haven't played in a long time. And I think it's gotten much more sophisticated since I played. And so,
in fact, it's probably not healthy for you to be pulled back into figuring out why you didn't
actually
win.
Somebody called the other day and they said, well, if you go online, it was this addiction specialist. And I said, Arnie, I don't think I should be sitting here downloading poker sites. Do you? I mean, I said, that's like an alcoholic, you know, tasting up the new vodkas to see which one is going to be the best. I said, enough is enough.
Right. You've quit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I never even think of it. I'm so over it. Huh. You know, that's all I can say. I'm just, it's not, so not a part of my life.
Well, the book, which is also very funny, is Hats and Eyeglasses, A Family Love Affair with Gambling. Martha Frankel, entertainment writer and author. By the way, I so smell movie here. Have people talked to you about that?
Yeah, but you know what? My best friend is Ellen Chenoweth. She's a big casting director. She did No Country for Old Men and Michael Clayton this year. And she would say, if she was here, I don't pretend to be a writer. Stop pretending to be a casting director. So I don't do it. But everybody says to me, who's going to play you? But it's not a game I play.
Martha.
There you go.
Martha, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, Monday on Here and Now. Guns on campus. A Utah student legally carries one, he says, to prevent another Virginia Tech. A Virginia Tech student says, don't carry a gun in my name. That's Monday. Still ahead today, the first general code of wartime conduct. Does it apply today? That's after the news. Here and Now. The fifth anniversary of the invasion of Iraq is next week. We wanted to look back at an insurgency that may hold lessons for today. Major General Henry Halleck, the General-in-Chief of Union Armies, dealt with insurgents in 1862. These were Southern rebels who were mounting hit-and-run attacks and melting back into civilian life. Halleck commissioned Dr. Francis Lieber to write what became known as Lieber's Code. It was the first general code of wartime conduct, and it influenced all subsequent codes, such as the Geneva Convention. Lieber, a Prussian-born veteran of the Napoleonic Wars, was also a Gatsby-like, self-made American scholar with sons fighting on both sides of the American Civil War. David Bosco is assistant professor at the American University School of International Service. He's written a fascinating essay on Lieber and his code for the American Scholar magazine. And David, what was Lieber doing here in the U.S.?
Well, he was actually escaping political persecution. He had fallen in with some nationalist groups in Prussia growing up there and during his education there, and had found that it was no longer a comfortable place for him. And he left actually for England first, and then came over to the United States in the 1820s. And so he kind of set himself up as a self-made man here in the United States, began in Boston, and then made his way south, actually, to South Carolina.
He was teaching in South Carolina.
That's right.
Now, why did a Union general feel the need to turn to an historian and political science scholar and someone with roots in the South in the summer of 1862? Remind us.
Well, it's interesting. Lieber had actually kind of cultivated the relationship with Henry Halleck, who on his own was an international lawyer and something of a recognized scholar in his own right. And Halleck just found himself to be very frustrated by this phenomenon of Southern insurgents and hit-and-run bands. And Lieber had kind of presented himself to Halleck in part because he wanted Halleck's help in promoting his sons who were serving in the Union Army at that time.
In fact, he had sons on the Union side and one on the Confederate side who died.
Francis Lieber, in the run-up to the Civil War, he eventually left South Carolina. He found that politically it had become an untenable place for him. And so he and his family moved north, and he took a teaching position at Columbia. But one of his sons, Oscar, remained in the South and actually joined the Confederate Army and was killed shortly after the Battle of Williamsburg.
This was a man impacted by the Civil War, and now he's drawing up rules how to engage the enemy. He joins with the North. And there was a lot of, you know, to draw upon, a long history of thinking about just war. You cite St. Augustine, Thomas Aquinas. Rousseau said wars take place between states, not civilians. And then after the Crimean War, there was a movement in Europe right about this time that produced the Red Cross.
Yes, there was this kind of parallel movement toward codification of the rules of war. As you say, there had been these movements and this discussion about what was permissible in warfare and what was not. But what was new was that both in Europe and in the United States, there was this effort to really create clear rules of the road and to move it into the realm of law rather than just the realm of ethics.
But he ran up against that most difficult of questions. Yes, he wrote, and we want to hear more what he wrote, that, you know, civilians should be protected. But he was not disposed towards insurgents.
That is absolutely correct. To his mind, there should be a clear distinction between people who are willing to play by the rules of the game and those who were not. So people who operated, you know, not in uniform and melted back into the civilian population, he thought that it was perfectly fair and just to treat those people as brigands or thieves and you know, even perhaps to summarily execute them.
Well, and then, you know, he and others during the Civil War ran into this, it would seem, the same question that bedevils leaders today, because as you write, as blood is shed, moral constraints are loosened, so it becomes increasingly difficult to swear to protect the civilians if you can't tell the civilians from the insurgents.
Yes, that's correct. And even more broadly than just that question of insurgents, there is just this general pressure on our moral limitations as we go through wars. And so part of what happened during the Civil War is that, you know, initially from the Union perspective, this was a radical group from the South, and Union leaders thought that maybe we should try to cultivate, you know, the Southern population and separate them from their radical leadership. But as the war went on, that faith that somehow you could separate the Southern people from the Confederate leadership really faded. And Union strategy became to, in essence, punish Southern civilians, not so much by necessarily directly attacking them, but attacking the economy. And Sherman's March, of course, was kind of the culmination of that strategy.
It was a scorched earth policy.
Yes, absolutely. And Lieber really struggled with this in the code about military necessity versus the limitations of moral principle.
Right. I mean, he pretty much said, and I'm really paraphrasing here, but the most important thing is that we save the Union.
You can really read his code in many different ways. And the Confederacy really picked up on this ambiguity in the code, and they reacted. The Confederate Secretary of War released a very scathing commentary on Lieber's code saying, look, this is a fatally ambiguous document that can bless the most vicious campaign or the most restrained. And so a code that really can be read in so many different ways, what good does that serve?
Well, what good did it serve? Because you write that this emigre professor made one of the most substantial contributions to the modern law of war.
Yes.
But if he didn't settle that question, you know, which is still a question today, then what was this big contribution?
Yes. And in some ways, it's almost possible to see that his contribution was more substantive in terms of the future development of the law of war than it was actually to the fighting during the Civil War. To be fair to him, he did try to restrain the impulse in the Union to punish the South. For example, when there were revelations about Southern mistreatment of Union prisoners, saying, look, we can't yield to this desire for temptation by, for example, executing or torturing Southern prisoners.
Stoop to the levels of our enemies.
Exactly. But trying to calculate the effects of the law of war and these moral restraints is often very difficult because they do seem to operate in some ways almost like a speed limit. Yes, they're violated all the time, but if they weren't there, the violations might be even more extreme.
That's pretty powerful considering how bloody and awful the Civil War was. You're
yes.
saying maybe it might have been worse.
It is a hard thing to imagine given how bloody the last century and a half have been. But things certainly could have been worse, and I think it's fair to say the law of war has had a restraining influence.
And so what do we take from all of this today, David?
What is noble about Francis Lieber's effort here, and also Lincoln, of course, endorsed Francis Lieber's effort, what is noble is that they were trying to keep their conduct within the boundaries of law. They were at least trying to say, we recognize that we need to be bound by something. And that acknowledgement that even as you struggle with exactly what it is you're being bound by, the acknowledgement that we are going to be bound by something is, I think, a valuable lesson to take and apply it to the present situation, because there are people who want to say, well, we shouldn't be bound by anything, that anything goes. And for all the problems you can point out in Lieber's code, certainly he did not endorse that view.
David Bosco, assistant professor at the American University School of International Service. Thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thanks very much.
Okay, before we go today, Pat Metheny on Jazz Trios. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, let's let's take a few minutes to hear some of your thoughts. After yesterday's report on the growing problem of people cutting down other people's trees to sell for hardwood, Lane Brown of Rowley, Massachusetts wrote, "Timber poaching is also the term used when someone cuts a public tree down to enhance a private view. I used to work for the National Park Service at Cape Cod National Seashore and actually encountered someone who cut trees to enhance their view. Whether it's taken for use as lumber or because it's in the way doesn't matter. That tree is still public property." Teresa McPhee of Fraser, Michigan wrote, "After our conversation with Jim Roosevelt, co-chair of the Democratic National Committee's Rules Committee, we were talking about whether Florida and Michigan delegates would be seated at the Democratic Convention, and Teresa wrote, 'I just have one thing to say. No one has the right to take away my vote. I think the Democrats should have sanctioned the states instead. Splitting the cost to redo the primaries would make this voter happy.'" Well, producer Karen Fritch was very unhappy when the eclectic national grocer Trader Joe's discontinued her favorite tea. Well, her report touched a nerve. Here's Laura Jones of Easton, Connecticut.
"I, too, love the red box masala chai tea. I had no idea it was being discontinued. I have half a box in my cabinet, and on this dreary, snowy day, we'll now have a cup, celebrating the way things we love come and go in our lives."
"Hi, my name is Julie Ferdino. I live in Fairfield, Connecticut. My item was Gyoza dipping sauce. So after that was gone, we couldn't even buy the Gyoza, the pot stickers anymore, because we're good with it without the dipping sauce. And like Karen, I keep going to Trader Joe's hoping that one day I will see my dipping sauce again. So I just wanted to say thanks for that story."
In another recent story, we covered the battle between Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling and a website that wants to produce a lexicon of all things Potter. New York Times business writer Joe Nocera came down on the side of Rowling, but Robert Gamble, listening to our podcast in Posner, Poland, writes, "Nocera made a clear distinction between illegal derivative use, like making a movie without the author's permission, and fair use, like writing a commentary about the work's meaning. Well, I think that a lexicon is taking the product of Ms. Rowling's imagination and chopping it into pieces. Illegal. She should have the right to sell an encyclopedia about the world she herself created."
"Oh, Toby, the finest weed in the South Valley."
Well, from Potter to Lord of the Rings, a film with characters that smoke, like Bilbo Baggins here, the Health Commissioner of New York told us he wants films with smoking to be rated R because they're causing kids to smoke. Well, Tyler Stephenson in Tucson, Arizona wrote, "Come on, a bunch of tweens isn't going to run out and purchase long pipes to smoke while they practice their spell casting." Several of you also wrote, "After my President's Day nod to Richard Nixon, whose resignation provided me with a way to teach my nephew not to lie." Carol and Floyd Bass of Detroit wrote, "We laughed while listening, and now when we see a lie forming in the bubble over the head of our teenager, we solemnly remind him it's the cover-up, not the crime." Well, one of our favorite guests recently was Ken Jennings, who holds the record for the longest winning streak on Jeopardy and is constantly quizzed by people. He said the guy in the produce section asked him, "What's another name for solid leaf parsley?" And he answered, "Cilantro." Wrong. Liz McGillicus of Boston was one of many to write, "Ken had better find a new grocer. Flat parsley is Italian parsley. Cilantro is coriander." Admittedly, she writes, "I was only a four-time Jeopardy champion, but I, too, have a vast store of untapped trivia." And finally, Betsy Blackmore wrote after Renee Graham's piece on the 25th anniversary of Michael Jackson's Thriller. She writes, "I was dancing in my car while listening at a traffic light. Some gentleman standing on a nearby corner heard your music and busted out the moves. Thanks for the memories."
It's close to me.
Send your thoughts and any street corner sightings to letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Stay with us. Jazz legend Pat Metheny coming up here and now.
Pat
Matheny has a new CD, which is sort of like saying, the sun rose again today. Pat Metheny's legions of fans have come to depend on new sounds to add to their collections. This is the jazz guitarist's 35th album in 33 years. He's led his own group, also played with other jazz greats, Sonny Rollins, Charlie Hayden, Ornette Coleman, Brad Mehldau, winning 17 Grammys along the way. His latest CD is a trio record, Day Trip. This is the title track. Rolling Stone magazine says Pat Metheny thrives in the trio, so let's find out why. Full disclosure, he's an old friend, and we welcome Pat Metheny from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas. Hi.
How you doing, Robin?
Just fine. So, a trio CD. Which trios inspired you?
Well, one of the things that's great about guitar trio is that there are not those iconic, for instance, like if you say piano trio, I mean, you immediately think about Bill Evans. Mm-hmm. You immediately think about Oscar Peterson. If you're a saxophone player and you play trio, you immediately think about Sonny Rollins and those great Vanguard records or Ornette's trios. And actually, those are the same trios for me that are the iconic ones. With guitar, there never really has been, you know, that one centerpiece, like, okay, you must deal with this if you're going to play a guitar trio kind of thing. That's part of the appeal for me, is that it's wide open.
One of the songs on the CD has a Wes Montgomery kind of feel. Am I wrong on that?
I think there's a tune on the record called Calvin's Keys, which is a more kind of Kansas City swinging kind of tune. And that tune is actually dedicated to a guy named Calvin Keys, who was on the Kansas City scene in the years before I came around. And I always heard about him. And whenever I'd get a gig, somebody would say, well, I remember back when Calvin Keys used to do this gig, it sounded a lot better or whatever. And I'd be like, yeah, I'm sure it did, because I was like, you know, 13. Calvin was always this sort of figure on the scene, and I thought I would dedicate it to Calvin, so Calvin's Keys it is.
Tell us more about playing in the trio.
It's sort of the maximum amount of blank white paper that you can get and still have a full band sound happening. But because there's, you know, just that much room to work in, each guy and every little thing that each guy does matters.
Well, this is your first CD with bassist Christian McBride and drummer Antonio Sanchez, but you've played with them, you know, hundreds of times before, you know, recording this. So what does that mean for you musically, you know, as opposed to playing with, let's say, Brad Mehldau for the first time?
Well, I think that you're right. The way that we kind of go about making records these days more often falls into that category of you organize a project, you go into the studio and you make a record, and then you go out on the road, and that's usually where it starts to get really good. The way that I did it in pretty much all of my early records was that we would go out and play the music for quite a long time and then record it. And it just sort of worked out that way. You know, for the trios that I've had, they sort of fall into two categories. One is where there's people that are sort of an established unit, like, for instance, Charlie Hayden and Billy Higgins. Almost you could say it's an iconic rhythm section in jazz. But there have been more often other occasions where I've sort of done some matchmaking and put together a bass player and drummer who didn't know each other. And Jaco Pastorius and Bob Moses were like that.
For Bright Size Life.
Yeah, Bright Size Life. And this trio is like that. And it was sort of one of those things where you wake up in the middle of the night when you kind of go, wow, what would it be like if those guys played together?
Cool. Let's hear what it is like. Here's a song that really picks up the pace. It's The Red One. So the CD, you know, vibrant, but there's a reflective song in particular that jumps out. Is This America, Katrina 2005. It's about the devastation in New Orleans post-Hurricane Katrina. Tell us about how this song came about.
we were on tour in the Gulf Coast states, and you know, literally, that was the question that came to mind. Just that. Is this America? I mean, it didn't look like it was possible that that was coming from here. And the tune is not really a tune that necessarily speaks about that in an angry or resentful way. It's just really that. It's just a question. Yeah. I mean, can't we do better than that?
There is a classic sort of Pat Metheny exquisite sadness, you know, wistfulness to it. And I'm wondering, is it at all connected to This Is Not America, the song you wrote for Falcon and the Snowman, which was recorded by David Bowie?
Someday I'm going to write a song that's called This Is America. Yes, but I haven't gotten to that yet.
Little piece of you. Little beats in me will die.
This is not a miracle,
for this is not America.
You know, it's funny that the David Bowie song really is one of the great protest songs ever. I mean, his words are just beautiful.
Right. And Pat, before we let you go, I just want to make sure we've noted the late, great saxophonist Michael Brecker, who was your dear friend, died last year after a long battle with leukemia. His last album, Pilgrimage, won a posthumous Grammy. You and Herbie Hancock played on it, were real boosters. Your thoughts on that win.
Well, you know, it's a very bittersweet occasion, you know, to on one hand celebrate Michael's unbelievable coda as a musician. You know, what he was able to pull out under the physical conditions that he was working with, and then also to really, I would say, come up with his best record ever is something that is, I still can't really come close in words to what we all saw as he was making that record. And he should have won. I mean, it really was the best jazz record last year. And, you know, yet at the same time, there's that sense like, okay, you know, that was it. And, you know, we all have to move on from here, which we're, of course, trying to do. His loss in the jazz community, not only as a player, but also just as a guy, somebody who brought a lot of people together, that's something that's very much missed.
It's probably appropriate that we go out with some reflective music of yours from your new CD. This is Dreaming Trees. Listen to that from guitarist Pat Metheny's new trio album featuring Christian McBride and Antonio Sanchez. And I don't know, Pat, I smell NPR break music.
Well, thank goodness for NPR break music. That's all I can say.
The CD is Day Trip. For more, go to our website here-now.org. Pat, thanks so much.
Great talking to you, Rob. Good.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.